Think about the exact moment you realize you have, well, absolutely zero control over your life.
Yeah, that is a terrifying realization.
Right. And I'm not talking about a minor inconvenience like, you know, hitting traffic on your morning commute. I mean the absolute structural collapse of a plan you spent years meticulously building.
Sure.
Because society teaches us that if we just engineer our future correctly,
like picking the right major or securing the right investments.
Exactly. If we buy the right insurance, we are supposedly safe.
Yeah.
We treat the future like this this mathematical equation just waiting to be solved.
It is an incredibly seductive illusion, honestly. I mean, we crave predictability because it soothes the nervous system.
Yeah, it feels safe.
Right. If we can map out the next 5 to 10 years in a neat little spreadsheet, we basically trick ourselves into believing we have mastered the unknown.
Wow, yeah.
But the moment reality introduces a variable we didn't account for, that pristine blueprint just disintegrates. And the resulting psychological fallout is immense.
Which is exactly why we are gathered here today.
Ah.
So welcome, beloved family members, to this in-depth exploration.
We are really glad you are here with us.
Today we are unpacking a profoundly challenging sermon based on the biblical teaching found in Matthew chapter 6, verses 33 and 34.
It is a powerful message.
It really is. And the whole mission of this profound discussion is to dismantle our modern, paralyzing obsession with the future. It offers this incredible framework for reclaiming our mental and spiritual health by radically tethering ourselves to the reality of, well, today.
The core tension this sermon addresses is just so universal. I mean, every single one of us wants to secure our tomorrows.
Obviously. It's human nature.
Right. However, the central thesis of the message is that our frantic attempts to manage or predict or control what has not yet occurred is actively suffocating our present.
Man, that is heavy.
It is. True freedom, according to this teaching, is only achieved when we sever that emotional umbilical cord that connects tomorrow's hypothetical disasters to today's living reality.
So let us examine the root cause of this obsession, because the sermon starts by pointing out a really harsh truth about human limitation. We are, quite frankly, completely incapable of predicting the future, despite our disparate, hyper-advanced technological attempts to do so.
Yeah, and the sermon brings up some incredibly stark examples of this failure. I mean, we have entire industries built on prediction.
Oh, absolutely.
We revere these futurists and management theorists, figures like Peter Drucker or Alvin Toffler.
Right.
We feed these massive lakes of big data into supercomputers to generate predictive models. And yet, humanity is routinely blindsided.
We never see the big stuff coming.
Never. The message highlights visceral, undeniable proofs from the natural world. Consider the tragic events in Nepal, where seemingly permanent mountainsides unexpectedly just gave way.
Yeah, that was horrific.
Or the jagged, entirely unpredictable paths of typhoons, or just the sheer randomness of sudden earthquakes. Nature operates as a daily reminder that our scientific instruments, as advanced as they are, merely observe the present. They absolutely cannot guarantee the future.
And the unpredictability is not just limited to tectonic plates and weather patterns either.
No, not at all.
The sermon makes this sharp pivot to our current societal landscape, specifically how the COVID-19 pandemic aggressively accelerated the AI era.
Oh, that completely changed the game.
It really did. It used to be that human society moved at a pace we could, you know, somewhat track. Now the ground is literally shifting under our feet daily. We are seeing junior lawyers, individuals who spent a decade and hundreds of thousands of dollars mastering legal precedent,
yeah,
suddenly facing a job market where artificial intelligence can draft complex legal briefs in seconds.
The psychological whiplash of that is just staggering. You also see it in higher education, as the message points out.
Oh, the college majors, right?
Exactly. College freshmen are paralyzed, entirely unsure of what to major in, because the existential future of entire university departments is in question. The velocity of societal change has completely outstripped the human brain's ability to adapt.
Which leads directly to an epidemic of anxiety.
Precisely.
But this brings up a phenomenon mentioned in the sermon that I find utterly fascinating, because it highlights a massive cognitive dissonance in our culture right now.
What do you mean?
Well, as anxiety skyrockets due to this hyper-advanced, totally unpredictable world, people are not necessarily turning to more science.
Right.
They are turning to pseudo-religions, shamans, and fortune tellers.
Yeah.
The message specifically notes that popular modern tourist hubs like Hyundai and Guangali, are seeing young people just flocking to these mystics.
It is a brilliant observation on human psychology, because when high-end algorithms and logic fail to provide certainty, the human mind doesn't simply accept the unknown, it regresses.
Regresses.
Yeah, it reaches backward into ancient mystical frameworks, basically hoping that mysticism can offer the concrete answers that our modern spreadsheets cannot.
But the irony reaches an absolute peak when the sermon describes how these two worlds are literally colliding. Like, we now have fortune tellers who are taking traditional fortune telling methods.
You mean Saju?
Yes, specifically the ancient practice known as Saju, and they are attempting to combine it with stock market predictions.
The mechanics of that are so revealing. I mean, think about it. You have individuals using ancient astrological charts to try and divine a modern tech stock ticker symbol.
But it's wild. Why does this even happen?
Because when the data models fail, people attempt to project an aura of divine certainty onto financial chaos. It is a frantic, ultimately futile attempt to soothe the nervous system.
Yeah.
It proves that our obsession with predicting the future is much less about actual preparation and much more about trying to medicate our present anxiety.
Which transitions perfectly into how this broken relationship with time actually manifests in our daily lives. Like, how does it alter our behavior?
Right.
The sermon frames this through Matthew chapter 6, verse 34, where Jesus essentially personifies the concept of tomorrow. The instruction is, tomorrow will worry about itself.
By personifying tomorrow, the text establishes a very strict boundary. It treats tomorrow as a distinct, separate territory.
Like a different country.
Exactly. It's a jurisdiction that you have no legal right or capacity to enter today. The sermon explains that our core dysfunction is that we are constantly trying to time travel. We refuse to live in the present jurisdiction.
So true. And the message breaks this time, traveling down into two specific traps. So let us look at the past trap first. It describes individuals who are clutching onto trauma, perhaps inflicted by their parents, from 10, 20, or even 30 years ago.
Yeah.
As they physically age, they develop into what psychological frameworks call an adult child.
The mechanism behind the adult child is essentially an emotional freeze response.
Uh-huh.
When someone experiences profound hurt and they refuse or are unable to process it and leave it in the past, their emotional development halts at the exact age the trauma occurred.
That is so tragic.
It is. The tragedy here is that the present requires active, vulnerable engagement, but the past, even a highly painful one, is a known script.
So it feels safer.
Subconsciously, yes. They prefer the familiar pain of yesterday over the unpredictable risks of today. Therefore, they live entirely defensive, passive lives, and their today simply evaporates.
Then you have the complete opposite end of the spectrum. People trapped in the future. The sermon describes individuals who sit around writing detailed, completely fictional tragedies in their own minds.
Oh, the catastrophic thinkers.
Right. They visualize a fatal car crash before they have even signed the paperwork to buy a car. They anticipate the devastating emotional fallout of a divorce before they have even found someone to marry. They mentally fail an exam before they've even opened the textbook.
And the neurological cost of that is immense. Your brain actually struggles to differentiate between a vividly imagined threat and a real one.
Wait, really?
Yeah. When you draft these fictional tragedies, your body releases the exact same stress hormones as if the event were actually happening. You are burning the physical and emotional energy required to live today by fighting a phantom that literally does not exist.
I do struggle with this distinction, though. For all of our beloved family members listening, I think this is where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
If I am not feeling at least a little bit of anxiety about, say, my physical health in old age, I am probably never going to go to the gym.
Right.
Where exactly does responsible preparation end and this destructive, catastrophic worry begin?
Yeah.
Because I have a real obligation to save for retirement.
That is a highly practical pushback, and the sermon delineates the two beautifully. The line between preparation and worry comes down to agency and location.
Okay, unpack that for me.
Well, preparation is a concrete action that occurs strictly in the present. Setting up an automatic deposit into your retirement account takes 5 minutes today. Cooking a healthy meal is a choice you make today. That is preparation.
Okay, I see.
Worry, conversely, is an emotion stolen from an imagined tomorrow. It is sitting on your sofa, your heart racing, agonizing over a potential economic collapse that you have absolute zero control over.
Wow.
Preparation utilizes your present agency. Worry completely paralyzes it.
That distinction changes everything. Preparation is a tool for today. Worry is an anchor from tomorrow.
Beautifully said.
But acknowledging that is one thing. Actually managing the sheer volume of our responsibilities is another. If we cannot drag the future into the present, how do we systematically tackle the massive, lifelong obligations we all carry without becoming completely overwhelmed?
The sermon offers a very grounded analogy to explain how we survive this. It's the story of the bell ringer.
Oh, I love this part.
The premise is simple. A village bell ringer has a daily task to ring the bell 10 times, 3 times a day. That is 30 rings in total. It is a highly manageable, finite task.
But the danger comes when the human mind tries to aggregate the timeline.
Precisely. If that same bell ringer sits down and calculates his workload over a 30-year career, the math is terrifying.
Yeah, what was the number?
30 rings a day times 30 years means he will have to pull that heavy rope 328,500 times.
That's insane.
If he focuses on that aggregate number, the psychological weight of all those pulls will crush his motivation. He would likely abandon the job immediately. But the physical reality of his existence is that his muscles only ever have to pull the rope 10 times in any given moment.
The pastor who delivered this sermon actually shared a deeply personal equivalent to the bell ringer story. Over the course of 15 years, he led 75 incredibly rigorous early morning revival series.
That is a massive undertaking.
Right. And this was in addition to his regular duties, where he used to preach up to 67 times on a single Sunday.
Wow.
He confessed that if he had ever stepped back and looked at the aggregate mountain of work, like thousands upon thousands of intense, spiritually demanding sermons stretching out before him, he would have physically collapsed from the pressure.
I believe it.
The only way he survived that volume was by forcing his vision to narrow entirely to the 24 hours right in front of him.
It is the ultimate survival tactic for longevity. The sermon even references the cultural concept of the 10,000-hour rule for mastering a skill.
Right.
10,000 hours sounds insurmountable, but the mechanism of mastery is literally just showing up for one single hour today.
It makes me think of hiking a long, arduous trail with a really heavy backpack.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
If you are setting out on a trek that will take you a month, obviously you'd have to secure a month's worth of rations. But if you try to put all 30 days of food into your backpack on the very first morning, your knees will just buckle.
Yeah, your spine would give out.
You will not make it a single mile. You are physically and psychologically designed to only carry the weight of today's rations.
And this limitation is not a design flaw. It is entirely intentional. The sermon connects this daily limitation to a much larger theological framework regarding the nature of time itself, utilizing two concepts from ancient Greek philosophy, chronos and kairos.
Let us unpack the mechanics of those two terms, because this really changes how we view our daily routines.
Definitely. So, chronos basically represents ordinary sequential time. It is the ticking of the clock. It represents the mundane, repetitive tasks we all face.
So the morning commute, doing the laundry, responding to emails.
Not exactly. Ringing the bell 10 times. That's chronos.
Got it.
Kairos, however, is entirely different. It represents a critical, opportune moment. It is a time of divine intervention, a breakthrough, a moment where everything changes.
Okay.
What the sermon argues is that we all desperately want the kairos moments. We want the miracle. But kairos is exclusively birthed out of a faithful commitment to chronos.
In other words, you cannot manufacture a breakthrough.
No, you can't.
You cannot skip the boring, ordinary Tuesday and expect to experience a miraculous Wednesday. It is the radical obedience to the mundane tasks of today that slowly builds the foundation strong enough to hold a miracle when it finally arrives.
Yes. And the sermon anchors this requirement in the very nature of the divine. When God reveals himself in the biblical text, he uses the phrase, I am. He is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The phrasing is entirely in the present tense.
That's a huge distinction.
It is. God is not described as a distant, mechanical watchmaker who wound up the universe in the past and just stepped away. He is an active, present reality.
The message quotes the book of Lamentations, chapter 3, verses 22 and 23, which states that God's mercies are new every morning.
New every morning.
The implication here is just staggering to me. Because God is constantly operating in the present tense, doing new things, no 2 days are ever a copy of one another. We cannot allow the failures or the grief of yesterday to dictate the potential of today, because today is a functionally brand new creation with its own specific mercy.
This creates a profound philosophical boundary. I mean, if God is perpetually operating in the now, what happens when human beings vacate the present?
That is the exact question we need to ask. When I am sitting here, physically in the present, but my mind is paralyzed by a mistake I made 10 years ago, or I am sweating with anxiety over an economic shift that might happen 10 years from now, am I literally absenting myself from the only space where God is currently working?
According to this theological framework, yes. You are vacating the only jurisdiction where grace, mercy, and provision are actively being distributed. You are trying to draw resources from a timeline that doesn't exist.
But beloved family members, we have to ground this in the brutal reality of human suffering. It is very easy to conceptualize living in the present when your present is comfortable.
Oh, absolutely.
When the bills are paid, the house is warm, and you are in good health, focusing on today is pleasant. But what is the mechanism for survival when today is an absolute nightmare?
Right.
When today holds a terminal diagnosis, a sudden job loss, or a deep, agonizing betrayal.
The sermon does not gloss over suffering with toxic positivity, which is really important. Instead, it turns to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13, which offers a very specific promise that individuals will not be tempted or burdened beyond what they can bear.
Okay.
The underlying premise is that the Creator has an exact, intimate knowledge of your structural capacity. The pastor utilized a mechanical analogy here. God will not place a 2-ton load onto a truck that was structurally engineered to carry only 1 ton.
I understand the theology of that, but you know, the human experience often violently contradicts it. When you are in the middle of severe grief, it absolutely feels like a 3-ton weight has been dropped on your 1-ton frame.
It absolutely feels that way. But the sermon looks at extreme examples of biblical suffering to prove the point, starting with Job. Job's present reality was horrific,
to say the least.
Right. He lost his wealth, his children, and his physical health in rapid succession. It was a compounding tragedy. Yet the message argues that even this unimaginable burden was precisely calibrated to Job's massive spiritual capacity. The grace provided to Job was not a lifetime supply given all at once. It was the exact molecular amount needed to keep him breathing for just that one day.
The sermon also brings up the historical narrative of Joseph, which is perhaps the ultimate case study in how to survive an unfair present. Joseph's life was a masterclass in compounding trauma.
Yeah, one thing after another.
He is betrayed by his own brothers, thrown into a pit, trafficked to a foreign country as a slave, and just when he manages to build a stable life working in Potiphar's house, he is falsely accused of a horrific crime and thrown into a dungeon.
If anyone had a legitimate right to be paralyzed by the trauma of his past or terrified by the bleakness of his future, it was Joseph.
Precisely. If Joseph had sat in that dungeon and run the aggregate math on his life, if he had focused on the utter injustice of his past or the likelihood that he would die a forgotten prisoner in the future, he would have curled up against the stone wall and just withered away.
Right.
So what was the mechanism of his survival? The sermon points out that Joseph's strategy was radical, relentless dedication to the 24 hours directly in front of him. Whether he was forced to sweep the floors in a slave master's house or organize the daily routines of a dark prison cell, he poured his entire agency into executing today's tasks with excellence.
It is a remarkable display of letting go of what you cannot control. Joseph had absolutely zero control over the justice system of Egypt. He could not engineer his own release.
Not at all.
But he retained absolute control over his response to the immediate moment. He refused to let the despair of tomorrow contaminate his actions today.
This means Joseph's ultimate survival strategy wasn't some complex 10-year master plan to clear his name and escape. He didn't sit in his cell drawing up vision boards. His survival was rooted entirely in shrinking his world down to the daily ration of endurance.
And that brings us to the crux of the entire message. How do we synthesize this philosophy? How do all of you listening, our beloved family members, take this massive theological concept and practically apply it tonight, especially if you are at the end of a grueling day?
The sermon provides some immediate, actionable directives. It removes all room for procrastination.
Oh, I need this.
It states that if there is someone in your life you need to forgive, you must do the hard work of forgiving them today. If you need to express love, show gratitude, or offer repentance, you execute those actions today.
Right.
We cannot delay our relational healing or our spiritual growth, hoping that some future milestone, like a New Year's Eve service, will magically provide the motivation we lack right now.
But the most fascinating practical application of the message surrounds something that every single human being attempts to do every single night.
Sleep.
Exactly. The ultimate test of whether or not you have actually surrendered tomorrow is sleep.
This segment of the teaching completely shifts the paradigm for me. The sermon frankly addresses the fact that modern society is crippled by insomnia and sleep disorders. We are a culture running on fumes, staring at our phones at 2 in the morning, relying on heavy doses of melatonin just to force our bodies to shut down.
Yeah.
But the pastor makes a radical assertion. True, restful sleep is not merely a biological function. It is a profound act of faith.
If you examine the physiological reality of sleep, it is incredibly vulnerable. Your heart rate drops, your muscles experience a form of paralysis, and you enter a state of total unconsciousness.
You're completely helpless.
You are entirely defenseless against your environment. To willingly enter that state, especially when you know you have mounting deadlines, financial stress, or unresolved conflicts waiting for you the next morning.
Yeah, that requires a massive transfer of trust.
It completely reframes how we view a sleepless night. Usually we treat insomnia as just a biological glitch, a spike in cortisol, too much blue light from a screen, or a simple stress response.
Right, something we can fix with a pill.
Exactly. But in the context of the sermon, lying awake, staring at the ceiling at 3 in the morning, is essentially a spiritual wrestling match. It is the physical manifestation of our stubborn refusal to hand over the jurisdiction of tomorrow to God.
Wow.
We are lying there in the dark, burning up today's energy, attempting to mentally manage a future that has not yet arrived, simply because we do not trust the present tense God to hold the universe together while we rest.
To synthesize this entire profound discussion, true peace is not a product of predicting the future. We simply do not have the capacity for it, whether we rely on artificial intelligence or ancient astrology.
We just don't.
Peace is exclusively found in the discipline of severing the anxiety of tomorrow from the reality of today. We survive the crushing weight of human existence by living strictly in the present tense. We must trust that the capacity to endure our specific suffering is distributed daily, exactly like our daily rations.
The one-ton truck receives a one-ton load, and the grace provided is strictly for today.
Beloved family members, we want to thank you for joining us on this in-depth exploration of a message that so aggressively challenges how we operate in this frantic modern world. It forces us to stop trying to decipher the horizon, and instead demands that we focus on the ground directly beneath our feet.
It is an invitation to put down the heavy burden of the aggregate. You do not have to ring the bell 300,000 times today. You only have to ring it 10 times.
As we conclude our time together, we want to leave you with a final lingering thought, something for you to deeply consider tonight when your head finally hits the pillow. If it is genuinely true that tomorrow will worry about itself, what is the one heavy, exhausting scenario you are currently agonizing over that actually belongs to a day that has not even arrived yet?
Think about that hiker's backpack. What specific emotional or mental weight are you carrying this very second that you do not actually need until next month or next year?
What would happen to your mind, your body, and your soul right now in this exact moment if you just put that weight down and went to sleep?